Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi there, this is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for joining me for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. Over the next 20 minutes or so, we'll talk with two doctors about coronavirus and COVID-19. Coming up later, we'll talk about some new heart concerns regarding coronavirus. But first, let's talk with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Wanted to start out with getting your reaction to everything that we saw go on this past weekend at that pool party at Lake of the Ozarks. What do you think?
Well, it wasn't something I was excited to see. I'll just put it that way. I get it. You know, everybody's just kind of been pent up and, you know, it's probably been the first nice weekend we've had in a while. The weather's been hot. It made a lot of sense for a long weekend for traditionally people go down to Lake of the Ozarks. And it kind of goes to the bigger point. I mean, people are going to do what they're going to do. And, you know, those aren't always in interest of, or I guess with self-interest or even interest of their community in mind. And I always kind of think back to the idea of smoking. In no stretch of imagination does anybody think smoking is good for you, and nobody will agree with that. Yet still, you know, 10 or 15% of the population smokes, and you know it's kind of a classic trade-off of short-term gain for long-term disadvantage, and you know that's part of, in my mind, the human condition, and something that I deal with on a daily basis, because people make these choices, and they may not be the choices that others make, but they're choices that people make, and we have to deal with the consequences, both as a society and individuals. And so I kind of see it in that light of, I'm not surprised by this, because they didn't break any laws. There's been no policy set in place that dictates what we can do with our spare time. They put our public health at risk, and you know that needs to be recognized, and maybe everything will be okay, but you know, like we've seen with other scenarios, it just takes a couple people that are, you know, may not exhibit any symptoms whatsoever, but have this. And now they've exposed, gosh knows how many people there. And if they all return and intermingle with other people, again, this is where this runs away so, so fast. And, you know, we have had success. We've had some good efforts in this region to reduce these numbers, and that should be applauded. But it just takes one thing to kind of make that all for naught. And that's what I've been worried about. And I think I've been pretty clear in that. And I just worry that this might be kind of the tip of the iceberg. Maybe wrong. I don't know. But it just, this is, as we start to come out of this without much guidance and other elements in place we need to have, just this is how disaster strikes, if it does. It may not, but it's certainly concerning.
Even if you don't have symptoms now or you don't develop symptoms, then you could have picked this up, brought it back to our community, and put someone else at risk. So our request for people who went through that exposure this weekend is to stay home for the next 2 weeks to self-quarantine.
St. Louis County Executive Dr. Sam Page is calling on anyone that might have been at that pool party to self-quarantine for 14 days. What do you think of that?
I think it's great. It's just like me telling a patient to stop smoking. The success of that is insanely small. You know, the people that clearly just did not take any of this seriously don't strike me as the people that are going to have the self-awareness to self-quarantine afterwards. They clearly, you know, felt this was more important, and I don't think they'll feel that self-quarantine is more important. You know, again, without some kind of more stringent enforcement of this, it just, I don't see it likely to happen. Some might, but I don't think the majority will. But that's just, again, my opinion. I don't know, but it just seems to be what will happen.
So from your opinion as a doctor, what do people need to keep in mind?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is, I think some humility about this. And you know, we're doing this, all of our efforts right now, not just as healthcare providers, but as a community, is not just for our own individual health, but for the health of others as well. You know, we're still learning how this has spread. We're still learning, you know, we still don't know how many people have been affected by this. You know, clearly, I think the thing that just kind of I'm still in shock about and just am so worried about is how quickly this explodes. You know, and it just takes one instance where a large gathering of people are exposed, and then all of a sudden it just, the whole community is just decimated by this. Look at New York, and gosh knows how that started. In Milan, clearly there is a relation to this Champions League soccer game that occurred, you know, before this outbreak occurred, and there's a thought that that was a big area of spread. In South Korea, it was a church service where there's 3 symptomatic people and a congregation of about 1,000 or 1,500, I think, and a large proportion of them got sick. I mean, you know, and then just multiply that. You have 1,000 people exposed, and they all meet with 10 people or engage or interact with 10 other people that weren't there. All of a sudden, you're at 10,000 people. And if they all intermingle with somebody, say another 10 people, all of a sudden, you're at 100,000. Like, that's how explosive this can be. And, you know, I think recognizing that power, it's got to be part of our calculus of how we think about this. And that's what just worries me. And again, it may end up for nothing, and maybe all those people have already been exposed or immune. I don't know. But it's troubling. And, you know, even as we lifted the restrictions, I was worried about June anyway. You know, what does this tell us about, you know, what the fair amount of those people were from St. Louis and came back to the region? If we have a peak now in June, is it because of this Lake of the Ozarks outbreak, or is it because of our own loosening restrictions and maybe we got it wrong in that sense? We will not know now, and that's another part that kind of complicates everything.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital.
We're right in the middle of the first wave globally. We're still very much in a phase where the disease is actually on the way up. We need to be also cognizant of the fact that the disease can jump up at any time. We cannot make assumptions that just because the disease is on the way down now that it's going to keep going down, and then we're going to get a number of months to get ready for a second wave. We may get a second peak in this wave.
Dr. Buchholz, the World Health Organization says we're still not out of this first wave of coronavirus, and we might even see a second peak because of some irresponsible activities around the world as restrictions lift. You think so?
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. The way I think about this is right now, you know, particularly let's just look at the region. We've had a lot of success. You know, we're halfway through the baseball game. It's the fifth inning. We're up 5-4, but our pitcher had to get out early, and we've already gone through half our bullpen. And so we still have, you know, half of a game to play for. And it's, I think the same thing here is we've expended a lot of resources to get things under control, and we're having some success. But think about this. In this country, 100,000 people have died that may not have died if it wasn't for this. And, you know, that's just the start. You know, we're getting a handle on it, and it's getting a bit better. And certainly in a region, we've had some success. But there's very little to say if this, you know, like I said, just with this event over the weekend, if we had an increase in cases, I don't know if the healthcare system has the resiliency to deal with this. And it certainly looks, until we get some degree of immunity, which we don't know how many people have been exposed or immune to this, you know, what those numbers are, we're certainly at risk. We're not, you know, it's okay to kind of just say, okay, well, we're doing pretty well. We're in a better position than, you know, our opponent, but we still have a whole lot to go. And again, we got to think about how we're going to deal with this, because, like I said, we depleted a lot of our healthcare resources, you know, physical equipment, really just frankly the personnel, where everybody's kind of been working at a high level of alertness. That idea of fatigue is an important thing to think about, and already starting to see it a little bit. And so it's like I said, it's concerning to me, and I can't help but be nervous. I guess it's my job to be nervous, but I absolutely agree with the WHO. I think we've got to be paranoid and ready for more waves of this before it's over.
there's a new national campaign to get recovered COVID-19 patients to donate their plasma for study and for science and for treatments with their antibodies that could help those who have COVID-19 right now. What do you think of that? And tell us a little bit more about convalescent plasma therapy.
Yeah, so convalescent plasma therapy is just the idea that, that people have gotten COVID, really any illness, infectious illness, but in this case, COVID, and they've developed an immune response is basically to take plasma from those individuals which have the antibodies, the body's proteins that, that are designed to help fight off infection, and transfer those to a patient that's currently suffering from COVID and has not developed a response to it yet. And, you know, there's been a lot of anecdotal reports about how this has been effective. You know, again, we've had that same issue with hydroxychloroquine. We've had the same issue with remdesivir. You know, so you, but you have to do the important trial to really see if this works or not. And so that's where a big recruiting push is coming from, is scientists across the country and physicians across the country trying to recruit the people to get plasma so they can test this out and make sure that this is a treatment that has benefit. Anytime you give blood to anybody, there's some downstream effects too. It's not as, you know, safe, but it doesn't, it's not completely risk-free. There's a lot of complications from getting somebody else's blood that are well known and you know, difficult to treat potentially. So we need to do the science to make sure this is a safe and effective therapy. That being said, donations of plasma for people that have had COVID is certainly going to be accepted at most healthcare institutions and certainly appreciated. Top of that, you know, we're starting to run short of just our general blood supply. So whether or not you've had COVID or not, I certainly encourage you, if you're able to donate blood whenever possible, because we're running short of those supplies too. And that's incredibly important just for the treatment of acutely ill patients.
Dr. Buchholz, I have a listener question for you. This listener asks, if a family member is moving in from another state, should they get a COVID test before they come into my house?
If they can. The question is, you know, depending where they're coming from and where they're at, is the availability of that. However, if your family member thinks they may have been infected at some point, they could certainly get an antibody test. Antibody tests may not really prove that they're immune from COVID. It just shows that they may have been exposed and developed an immune response to that, which would be another helpful thing to say. But the COVID test, again, that nasal swab can be a little, you know, it's kind of open to interpretation in the sense that, you know, people may test positive but may have had it in the past. You know, you don't know if they're actively infectious or not, so it's a little tricky to kind of work through, as is the antibody test. I think the simple answer is, if you're going to move in, you know, I think some degree of space, you know, if you can do kind of some social distancing in the house, occupy one area of the house and then one person occupy the other area of the house, and maybe the person moving in, you deliver food into them, so kind of self-quarantine. You know, the duration seems to be a bit unknown. I think the CDC, if I'm recalling correctly, would say 7 to 10 days without symptoms. That's just kind of dependent on your own comfort level. But that would be like, you know, most extreme measure you could take.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for your help. Really do appreciate it again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Fred.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Now let's turn to Dr. Eli Azrak. Dr. Azrak is a cardiologist at SSM Health DePaul Hospital. He's here to talk to us about some new cardiac concerns regarding coronavirus and COVID-19. Dr. Azrak, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Fred.
I wanted to talk with you about this new report out that talks about right ventricle enlargement as a possible major predictor for mortality among COVID patients. What are you seeing?
Yes, this is an interesting study. You know, as you know, our knowledge of the epidemiology and the clinical features of acute COVID infections is evolving and changing all the time. This particular study is interesting in that it shows that given the limitations of a study, it's a small group of 105 patients at one hospital in New York, but it does show that right ventricular heart failure is a significant predictor of a poor outcome in acute COVID infection. So it teaches us to look carefully at the right ventricle of the heart when we face deteriorating COVID patients to understand how the right ventricle works.
How common is right ventricle heart failure?
Right ventricle heart failure happens in a specific set of situations where there's a lot of stress on the right ventricle of the heart, whether it is from a heart attack or lack of blood supply to that particular chamber, or through a secondary mechanism such as a very high pressure in the lungs or in the left side of the heart that causes the right side of the heart to fail. The purpose of the right side of the heart is to pump the blood into the lungs to get new oxygen, and then from the lung to the left heart to get pumped to the system.
So of the 105 patients in this study, 32 of them, or 31%, had dilation of the right ventricle based on an echocardiogram, and of those, 41% died by the end of the study period, compared to 11% of those without right ventricle enlargement. So what do we do with this information?
Yes, and this is definitely a significant discrepancy between the two groups. So in the group which had marked right ventricular enlargement, a much higher percentage ended up dying, which means they were probably much, much sicker than the other group. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that right ventricular failure was the primary cause of death, but it can give us insight into the ongoings of what is happening in those patients with the acute infection. Is there blood clots in the lungs that are not being detected, and they're only being detected through the failure of the right ventricle? Is the pressure in the lungs so high, or are they requiring such very high ventilator settings that are raising the pressure and causing the right ventricle to fail? All of these questions are probably in need of further investigation. But what we can learn from this particular study is that, first of all, doing what we call point-of-care ultrasound on the heart, which is bedside ultrasound, to look at the left side of the heart and as well as the right side of the heart. So that's the one thing. It's important to do a point-of-care ultrasound in the intensive care unit in particular. The second part is to pay attention to the right ventricle and see how it's functioning, because now we know that if it's functioning poorly, that subset of patients is at much higher risk for mortality.
Do regular people know if they have a problem with their right ventricle?
Usually, the majority of individuals who have right ventricular failure usually get it after having a problem with the left side of the heart for long enough time that now the right side of the heart is failing. There is a minority of situations where there's an isolated failure of the right ventricle of the heart, and that is usually either when there's lack of blood supply to the right ventricle from either a blockage or a heart attack that affects the right side of the heart in isolation, or sometimes when there is an acute rise in the pressures inside the lungs that cause a very high resistance against which the right ventricle has to pump, and that makes it fail and dilate and basically fail very quickly.
So what message is it that you want heart patients to know when it comes to coronavirus, COVID-19, and what they should be doing or looking out for?
Yes, so caretakers have learned tremendously over the past few weeks on how to deal with acute coronavirus infection. Now we know, and the professional society guidelines also alert us that we need to do point-of-care ultrasound on the sicker patients, especially those admitted to the intensive care unit. The second point, the teaching point here, is that we need to pay attention to the right ventricle just as much as we need to pay attention to the left ventricle of the heart because of the prognosis implications. The third point here is that to also look beyond the right ventricle of the heart and see, to figure out what is going on with the lungs. Are the lungs part of the problem that is driving the right ventricle to fail, and then why. We know in acute COVID infections, blood clots can happen in both small blood vessels as well as larger blood vessels. So looking for blood clots in the blood vessels of the lungs, blood vessels of the heart, and understanding the reasons behind the right ventricle failure are probably very important.
So your message to people with heart problems is continue doing all those things you need to do to keep safe and try and prevent coronavirus?
And it is obviously, of course, and obviously very critical that we not abandon the evidence-driven, proven treatments for heart failure, which we strongly recommend. And people should not be quitting or changing their medications unless they discuss that with their physicians. We know that acute COVID infections can affect the heart, and people need to be very careful about changing their medicines, as well as taking all the precautions necessary if they have underlying heart condition to stay isolated socially and distance themselves and protect themselves.
And don't be afraid to go to the hospital or go to the ER if you think you're having a heart problem.
If you're having any change in symptoms that could be related to your heart, chest pains, shortness of breath, swelling that's out of proportion to what you would expect, please call your doctor, and or if the problem is getting worse, go to the emergency room. We can take care of you. You will be safe. We have the capacity. The healthcare system is able to take care of you.
Dr. Azraq, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Fred.
Dr. Ellie Azraq is a cardiologist at SSM Health DePaul Hospital. And that's all the time we have for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for listening, and join us again tomorrow.